9 a.m., it's time for the Plant Rant, made possible by Baker Orchards at Centuria, and Sandra the Plant Lady is here. Good morning, Sandra.
Good morning, Bob. Just one item on the community calendar, and we will get started because, as everyone knows who listens to the show, it goes by fast. Winter St. Croix Valley Food Alliance Winter's Farmers Market. They have one more scheduled. It'll be March 17th from noon until 3. So, and that's in the greenhouse at the Acreage, which is the old Aveda estate. So in Osceola there. So exciting. This morning, my guest is Jeremy Williamson. He is a wetland plant specialist currently working in Pine County, Minnesota. Mm-hmm. So, but he's a local Amory guy. So anyway, good morning, Jeremy. Thank you so much for coming on.
Good morning.
So Jeremy has a lot of notes here.
Oh, yeah.
So I guess we could just start with, like, what is considered a wetland? Let's just start from the ground up. Get it?
Well, that's actually a loaded question.
Okay.
So, like in Minnesota, where I'm at now, Minnesota or Wisconsin does it similarly. We work off of the Fish and Wildlife Service's Circular 39.
What does that mean?
What that does is it classifies wetlands based off of the hydrology and the plant community.
Okay.
So right now we are regulating off of that, and it classifies 8 different types of wetlands.
Oh, and then so based on if it's a wetland that has like cattails or a wetland that has different
shrubs,
species, like pieweed or other, okay.
Like a speckled alder. It could be just a wet meadow.
Okay.
Where you see like wet prairie plants. Or it could be, and I get this all the time, like, well, that's not a wetland. It's only wet in the spring in the forest.
Oh.
So you, those low depressions when you're walking through the woods often could be a wetland. And that's because the plants have all these special adaptations, and they'll only grow in certain conditions that they're adapted to. And there's all kinds of actually fun little invertebrates and stuff, too, and those types of things.
So the whole ecosystem... So you said there's eight different wetland names, so to speak,
right.
And different types, and that would be based on the plant and animal species that are in those environments.
Right. And so that's actually a fairly simplified classification.
Right.
And then there's a bunch of other ones that are, there's, you know, a plant community one. Minnesota's moving towards like a hydrogeomorphic classification, which is basically kind of landscape type position. And then I like
the elevation of,
right. Is it a mineral flat and then, or a depression, or is it concave or,
okay.
And then how the water moves. That's what I've noticed the difference between working in Wisconsin and Minnesota. Wisconsin seems, this is my perception, of course, seems very biology based. Minnesota seems very geology based, and I don't know why.
Interesting. So actually, looking at the parent material of the soil or what's underlying it.
And so to be a wetland, you have to have 3 classifications. So you may have one of these things, but not the others. So you have to have the vegetation, which is why we're here, right? you have to have wetland soils, which is why those plants are there. So you look at different color, texture, things like that. And then you have to have the hydrology. So how is the water moving? Where does it sit in the landscape?
Where is it coming from? Where does it go?
It could be groundwater, which would be like a calcareous fen, which are super cool wetlands. It's like a bog, sort of, but the water is real alkaline. There's lots of calcium in the water. And the plant community is just insane.
Loving it.
Yeah
they're like, woohoo.
Yep. So it's pretty neat. And then bogs, I love bogs. That's probably one of my favorites.
One in Wisconsin, we're blessed. I mean, this is where our cranberries come from. I mean, huge ocean spray all around, Warrens and Toma in that area.
Yep.
Huge cranberry bogs.
Exactly. Well, and there's wild cranberries. You can drive just north of Luck here and go to the Marsh Lake Wildlife Area. And there's
go wild crafting?
There's wild cranberries, yeah.
Oh, fun.
Yeah.
Do people harvest those? Do you need a permit or anything?
Oh, it would take you forever to fill up a yogurt container.
I know, but it'd be fun. I mean, nobody eats that many cranberries.
But if you're walking around, I mean, here's a little snack or whatever.
Right on. Oh, I'll have to look for that. That's interesting. So,
and, you know, wetlands, I mean, there are, if you think globally, I mean, rice, here, wild rice, which is fairly sensitive. You know, people love wild ricing and things like that. So, I mean, that's wetland plants.
Taro in Hawaii. Yeah, that's in a Hawaii. Huge food staple. Yeah. They eat the root of that, correct?
Correct, yeah.
Okay, it's like a tuber.
Yep. Well, and cattails, every part of a cattail during some part of the year is actually edible.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah, I used to be part of an herb group, and I had a lot of cattail recipes. I never did try them, but you can use every part of it. Yeah,
absolutely.
It's just amazing.
Yeah. Yep. So, I mean, yeah, every time I'm out, because there's people who know even more than me, and I learned something. You know, when I was doing my previous stuff, we mostly did lake things, which are complex and it's great. But the more I'm doing the wetland end of things, the complexity of it is mind-boggling.
Well, and to have a job where you are learning all the time.
Yeah,
so you're
great.
Not getting stagnant in your work. It keeps you excited.
Yeah.
And you're open to listen to learn from other people. And I'm sure that you have knowledge to share with them. So
yes,
I love that type of an atmosphere.
Well, and so when we have, say, a problem, we have a technical expert panel that goes out, which is great because I have like a soils guy who comes from the state, and then I mostly do the vegetation. We have a geologist and then some regulation folks, and we all confer, like, what's going on here? How do we fix this and move on? So I've learned my soils knowledge has grown exponentially since I've started doing more.
Yeah, I can imagine. And soils are tough. That was one of my harder classes, although it didn't help that the guy was going through a divorce that quarter. So I think he was extra stern, maybe. But anyway, soils are hard.
Yeah.
And there's a lot to know with soil science.
Well, and hydric soils especially, which is why the certain plants that are in wetlands grow there. They're anoxic, so there's no oxygen. Depending on the type of wetland, we just said a fen is really alkaline, but a lot of times they're acidic. They might be crazy organic. So like in a bog, it's almost all decomposing plant material.
Right,
so
right.
It's almost analogous to like a coral reef. Whereas coral dies, more coral just grows on top of it. So in a bog, as the sphagnum moss dies, more sphagnum just grows on top of it. And similar to lake sediment cores, which I believe I've talked about on here actually before, you can do peat cores and see how environment and see how hydrology has changed and things like that. And that's
like a core sample of the peat, and you can see like layers then?
Yeah, because it's such low oxygen, it decomposes very, very slowly, which is why.
And then as it's decomposing, though, it's feeding, right? It's putting its nutrients up?
Well,
or how
oftentimes it's very low nutrient, too.
Okay.
Which is why bogs are so special, and they have a very, very unique plant community because they're adapted to a low nutrient, really wet, low oxygen environment. And people always think of plants as carbon dioxide, but they do require oxygen in their roots. So a lot of the adaptations of these things is why they're hydrophytes or water plants.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, I always tell people, like overwatering is worse than underwatering.
Yeah.
Because the cells can refill with water. But if you're drowning your plant, I always say your plant can't breathe under there.
Exactly.
But these plants have adapted to be able to breathe, so to speak, without that oxygen.
So like back to cattails, if you've cut a cattail root in half, there's huge air pockets in there.
So they've created their own air
space, well, at least a storage system, and they'll release that into the sediment too.
Okay.
And then you get into all kinds of microbiology and whatever, but they do that. Or like a speckled alder. We've all seen alder. In my experience, most landowners don't like it because it grows real thick, but it has really thick, what are they called?
Like in the root?
in the stems. Anyway, to bring in, they have like these hypertrophied lenticles.
Well, yeah, that's how you can really recognize it. I mean, aside from like the catkins or the little cones, yeah, you get all the lentil cells on the bark. So what are they using those for then?
Bring in oxygen.
It's opening up. It's like a big pore.
Yeah.
So if you go and look at the alder plant, folks, you'll see the speckled. They're usually multi-stemmed. Yeah. They're wetter areas. They have like a little cone on them. But yeah, the lenticels are those little specks, what makes them speckled.
Yeah.
And then so those are actually functioning as a pore,
yeah,
to let the air in.
Yeah.
Because aren't plants amazing? That's why, yes, I love this so much.
Or you might have like hollow stems or floating stems.
Sure. Well, like a bamboo, right? You cut a bamboo open and they've got a big giant, you know, they're sectioned off in big hollow tubes.
Or you can walk across the street in the summer. There's probably some bulrush. If you cut a bulrush off with a real sharp knife, you'll see all the stems to,
oh, sure,
to move oxygen back and forth and up and through.
So that's the reason why they're made that way, or why
it's
their function.
Like the seeds can be viable for decades. So right now we're in a drought.
scary. Yeah, yes.
We will be.
We are. Will be. Mm-hmm.
And so if you have certain plants, I think Joe Pieweed's one of them actually, where the seeds will drop, but it has to have a certain moisture regime to germinate. And it'll just sit there.
And wait.
And then once the soil has enough saturation, they'll germinate.
Oh, and Joe Pieweed's such a great plant. So good. The monarchs just go nuts on that.
And marsh milkweed.
Asclepias incarnata?
Yeah.
Okay.
So as I've been told, that monarchs actually prefer that over common milkweed.
Oh, yeah. You'll see them. They'll devour. I have some just in the garden at home, and they will devour that.
Yeah. And, so some of those wetland plants, I have them, and I've always had them in my gardens because I personally think they're even more attractive than, like, some of the prairie flowers.
Yeah, and let's talk about that for a little bit because our listeners, a lot of diversity, but, you know, my show kind of started out as a gardening program, and so some plants that people could look for, cardinal flower, the red lobelia, Monarda, would that be considered? I know I've had that in a wetter area before.
That's kind of wet, dry, sunshade, just workhorse.
Anywhere, right?
Yeah, it's like golden Alexanders, it's just a workhorse.
Some suggestions if people had a wetter area, or even, and you know, like, I mean, my swamp milkweed's in my regular part of the garden, but it happens to be...
Joe Pieweed, the bone set.
Oh, yeah.
A cup plant can handle quite a bit of water.
Oh, cup plant does.
Yes. It's very aggressive, especially if it has a really nice moisture regime.
So cup plant gets really big, and it gets its name from how the leaves come together around the stem, and if water will sit in there like a little cup, and it's... Typically, you see a lot of it, like, in a prairie.
Yeah.
But what I'm hearing is that it's pretty versatile. And they get huge. Like, they get 8 feet tall or something. So kind of a nice little screen.
And they're super rhizomatous.
Accent. So
they spread. But the goldfinches love them because they have water and food in the fall.
Oh,
I had a patch of it in my backyard at my old house, and I'd walk out and 40 goldfinches would fly out.
I love that.
So that's a great one. Blue vervain also can be kind of aggressive and spread. It's not really clumpy.
But these would be ones if you do have a wetter area and you want to develop it and make it look more attractive. You're in a spot where you're not necessarily constant maintenance, these more vigorous plants are good. And then it fills in and it looks nice. You have good habitat.
What's really nice is some of the sedges.
Yes, sedges have edges, people.
Yes.
Reeds are round. That's how you can tell.
Absolutely. They stay put. I mean, they'll get bigger.
But it forms a large clump. It
forms a clump.
Right.
So it really sets off, you know, these super colorful, because like I said, I think the wetland, you know, flowers are more vibrant than prairie stuff. A lot of the time. I won't say most of the time, but a lot of the time. When you add these sedges into it, then...
Well, it changes the texture. It gives you...
Yeah.
I think you can do a really a lot with foliage, with color and texture. to offset and then accent your plants.
And sedges have, we'll call them seeds. They're Perugnia is the name. I don't know why they're not seeds, but they're full of oil. So migrating birds who kind of habitat around those wetland edges really like the sedges because they're high in fat and high in energy. So it's also a wildlife attractant. So when you get those, like cardinal flowers, if you're looking at it as an attractive thing to have, you know, you get the lobelias. So now you have your hummingbird food.
Yes.
You have your Joe Pye weeds and things like that. Orange coneflower, it's a Rudbeckia. You have your seeds for your other songbirds. Then you have your sedges, and they're going to be, you know, that when that migration comes through.
Yeah, so you've just got a whole menu now out for these birds, and then you're going to attract them.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can enjoy them yourself, the beauty of it, and not be spending money, so much money on bird seed either.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have a lot. I mean, we have bird feeders, but there's way more birds in our natural prairie area and woods area than there are ever at the feeder. So
I love it.
Other than the, you know, stupid orioles that cry when there's not jelly out.
Right, yeah, the hummingbirds that look at you through the window. Mm-hmm. Hello.
Yeah, but...
Well, and it's interesting. So there's a place where I stay down on Lake Onalaska,
mm-hmm.
and that's part of the national flyway.
Yeah.
And there is wild rice mm-hmm. there, and it is protected primarily for migrating birds as their food source as they're going down that riverway.
Yeah, absolutely. So the other part about the attractiveness of it is we're always trying to control runoff, right? Absorb pollution, things like that.
Yeah, wetlands are like nature's filtration system,
like a
correct?
Great big kidney on the landscape.
Oh, I like that analogy.
So these plants, you know, even, you know, small lot in town here, if you wanted to do a small rain garden, it doesn't need to be a huge depression as long as the moisture is right. And a lot of Amory, the moisture is right.
Yes, yes. Without the dam, we'd be sitting in the river right now.
Yeah. I mean, you could... You can make this super attractive area to infiltrate runoff and provide habitat and do the whole thing. The pond down here at, they call it now Flagpole Park, mm-hmm. Essentially a wetland filled with cattails. It's not quite how it should be.
Right, right. As far as compared to how it should end, but it's functioning.
That pond, because I was part of the planning on that, that filters essentially like 9.5 acres of stormwater.
Wow.
That runs to it.
That little spot, 9.5 acres of stormwater.
Yeah.
Is getting filtered through that.
So, and then you think,
wow.
I just did a thing on hazards and flooding frequency and stuff. Mm-hmm. You think about like the Red River, Fargo, whatnot. Why does it flood? Well, because you drained all the wetlands. So where I'm at now, like 80% of pre-European settlement wetlands exist. So they say. I might debate that.
Yeah, that number seems high.
It does. But as you go south towards the metro, you get, you know, 50%. And then as you go further south in that Corn Belt area, it's like, they just call it less than 50%. But
and they could probably use some filtration there, I'm guessing.
Right. So, I mean, they're flood deterrents. You know, like some people hate beavers. Beavers are actually wonderful architects that create these wetlands. I mean, I'm guilty of it. I used to work for a trout stream crew, and we broke a lot of beaver dams.
Right.
In reality, they're actually fantastic. So out west, where beavers are pretty much extirpated, right, they killed most of them. They're trapping beavers from the Midwest and bringing them back out.
Oh, for the love of...
Because...
Why do we do this? Let's kill the wolves. Let's bring the wolves back. Let's go, it's like the turkeys. Now they're...
But the habitat they create, one, they create standing water. So in drought situations, there's constant water supply. The vegetation is wetland vegetation. It's wet. So it's kind of a refuge for wildfires, things like that. So you have this architect of an animal completely changing the plant community because it changed the hydrology. So you have this small stream where the banks might be, you know, steep, dry, whatever. They dam it up, they expand it, they create that hydrology in that wet space and creates this refuge for vegetation, wildlife, so food and water after everything else is burned off.
Well, and we want those plants to hold in those riverbanks and things. When you, when you know, all the shoreline restoration stuff that's going on, and like, yes, just putting rocks there, you're not assisting in anything. You put plants down and their roots are going to hold and anchor that soil in. And
yeah.
So now we're on a whole nother subject, but that's why it's called Plant Rant, people.
Well, I mean, and
but it's so interesting.
There's, you can fix a lot of problems with vegetation. I mean, realistically, you know, you think about some of my work here and what they're working on here locally is some of the farmer-led council stuff with, you know, using no-till and cover crop. Well, that's plants. It's roots.
Yes.
It's biomass. And that's why...
And natural fertilizer, folks. I mean, instead of spending all this money on things, you can be planting a plant that you mix into the soil and it creates the healthy environment and feeds the soil and...
Well, it creates organic matter. And that's kind of where these wetlands act as a sponge. Not all of them. I mean, you have some that are pretty mineral, like the wooded ones we talked about. But you take like a typical like marshy habitat. Well, bogs, we already talked about bogs. It's mostly dead plants. It's almost all organic matter. In areas like that, when you dig into it and look at it, you're going to have 8, 10, 24 inches of this black, mucky, organic, you know, great stuff. And when you dry it, it's like blows away in the wind. So it's not necessarily the greatest topsoil, but it does, it holds water, sucks out all those nutrients because there's the roots of the plant. There's all the microbes living on the roots.
Yes.
That's really where it happens, which is why the oxygen is important. Is that the roots release some oxygen so those microbes can essentially live. And you're holding all of that in and reducing nutrients before it gets to, you know, water bodies where, luckily in Wisconsin, we drink mostly groundwater, but, you know, in other parts of the country, not that far away, maybe reservoir water is your water source. So if you can filter that, and constructed wetlands are used for stormwater, and in some places, even for sewage treatment, they create these biofilters that are essentially wetlands to filter sewage, essentially.
Right, so it's not at such a high level where it's toxic or dangerous or for people and for other animals.
Right. So that's called phytoremediation, I think, is what they call it, or something like that.
It's so interesting.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, the plants are so super cool. And like the wetlands are classified, the plants also are. So there's obligates, which they only grow in a wetland. There's, we call it fac wet. So it's usually in a wetland, but it might grow in an upland.
This is a plant?
Yes.
The obligates are plants as well?
Yep.
Okay.
So those fac wet ones are like the garden plants we talked about, the, you know, cardinal flower, Joe pieweed, things like that. There's fac plants. Here, I think we have enough of a boreal effect. It's a terrible example because it's classified as fac wet, but like swamp milkweed is, it'll grow upland, right?
Yes.
So that would be an example, although it's not fac. So if anybody's doing a wetland delineation, don't do that. Then there's fac up, where it's mostly in the upland, but once in a while you'll see it like on the edge of a wetland, and then there's this upland. So, for example, I was just at a site the other day. It was a commercial site, and basically if anybody's doing anything in wetlands, they kind of consult with us. And we went there, and I walked out, and it was popple trees and bracken fern. I said, there's no wetlands here. See you later.
Interesting. That was enough. Just identifying the plant material was like, nope.
Yep. That's not always the case. Like, if you're going, like... there's a lot of beef cattle up there. So, like, a pasture might be all brome grass, right? And I've, you know, I've seen that here, too, doing some stuff south, like, near the Somerset area for development. And it's all brome grass. So you kind of follow, again, the hydrology. Where is water going to flow here? Then you're reliant on soils. Because something like brome grass, it'll grow anywhere. It's an upland plant, but we do find
it. So you can't determine, yeah, you can't base a decision on that.
Yeah, but in a natural setting, usually you can tell. Usually. I've also done one where the line where the wetland starts and the upland started was the difference between giant goldenrod and Canada goldenrod. And there was
how do you identify the difference between those two species of plants?
Giant goldenrod is hairy and Canada goldenrod is smooth.
Okay. So the foliage stem. And the stem. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. I learned something I love ideas.
And that was the line. And it was all goldenrod.
Wow.
And so the guy who did it was just lights out good because he was like, here's my line, here's why. And we're like, wow, that's pretty impressive.
Talking about you're looking at places where it's about to be developed because are we wanting to protect our wetlands? I mean,
correct.
These wetlands could be functional for these developments because if you're preserving it, you're going to have houses with runoff and things so they can be using that to actually keep it clean and make it safer. But you just don't want to be disturbing the wetland while you're building.
Right. And there's very, very specific rules in Minnesota. So it's the Wetland Conservation Act. It's kind of a national model, actually. It was developed in 1991. It's gone to court many, many, many times. I've only been there 3 years plus, and I've almost got to court, but I think it's lost like one or two times since 1991.
And I'm imagining it's the developers that are wanting to...
Not always.
No, okay.
it's just a rock-solid law, and it's pretty clear, but there's lots of layers. So, I don't know. It's kind of neat, but... Yeah, it's cool. Like up there, it's like I'm in an 80% area mostly, and I see some really cool stuff. Seen a white pine bog, which is nationally really rare, because some of those, like birch. For my whole life, I've always thought of birch as kind of being wettish, but in reality, they're not. But once in a while in a wetland, they essentially like white pine does, and you see jack pine and...
Man, what about tamaracks?
Tamaracks.
We've got some right here, you know, along 65 there. There's some nice little tamarack slough, right?
Oh, I have them in my yard. It's like my favorite tree. According to the foresters I've worked with, it used to be the most common tree in Minnesota, but it does not compete well with others. So now it's relegated to wetland areas.
Oh.
So I've been told.
Interesting. Well, now we have more to... ponder. Love to have you on again.
Yeah.
Because I feel like we're just kind of just scratching the surface.
So like when you see those little islands of birch and popple in like the middle of a wetland, essentially they're creating their own island by, it's really cool. That's a whole nother half hour. Anyway, it's really neat.
We'll have to have you back. I mean, as far as I know, I don't think I have a guest lined up yet for next month. So I don't know, maybe come back and do this again. Well, thank you, Jeremy. So Jeremy Williamson, Wetland Specialist with Pine County, Minnesota. Archives are usually on WPCARadio.org, usually by Monday. Luann's always on top of that. Thank you, Luann. So if you missed anything or want to hear again, there was a lot of knowledge there and probably some things to look into further if you're interested. Thank you also to Baker Orchard for underwriting.
I just have to say, I haven't chimed in here at all, but it's good to see Jeremy Williamson back in the studio.
So
he used to be here all the time.
Yeah,
every 2 weeks,
something like that. Yeah,
good to see you back.
People are probably really happy to have you on again.
Well, hopefully again.